Christmas Day with Damien Trench. And so it has arrived at the Trench household. And so tradition dictates that Anthony plays Christopher Dean to my Jane Torvill as we blend to create a meal fit for not one, but three kings, by which I mean my mother, my father, and Anthony's sister, Harriet. I'm using the word king in a purely metaphorical sense here. I'm not saying that my mother or Anthony's sister are in any way manly, although Harriet, it must be said, attacks soup with a vitality that makes even Anthony blush. Which is why when she visits, we always serve a salmon dish to start. We haven't always spent Christmas at home, however. I did once volunteer at a soup kitchen on Christmas Day. Anthony and I both just wanted to help, but I'd only taken charge of operations for about 15 minutes when someone very sincere came over and told me that, having had a bit of a chance to think things over, it had suddenly occurred to her that on second thoughts she was actually inundated with help, and really the best possible thing that I could do for the homeless was to go home and put my feet up. Which I duly did. I'll do anything for charity. A lot of people, even people who don't normally imbibe large quantities of alcohol, seem to start drinking really rather early on Christmas Day. It frightens me sometimes. It really does. People treat the whole festive season as if it's some sort of license to go at it, like teenagers at a pop festival. My own partner, Anthony, for instance, is someone capable of consuming an absolutely terrifying volume of liquid, but generally, other than at barbecues, of which he is regrettably all too fond, that is something he tends to do during the evenings. And yet at Christmas, even if we've slept in after attending a midnight mass, it's not unusual to hear corks popping out at a little after 10 in the morning. That sort of behaviour might be acceptable amongst shift workers, but it seems rather foolhardy otherwise. If I already have a headache by noon, then I simply don't stand a chance of being at my best in the kitchen, and that is a possibility I will not countenance. Not on today, of all days. My mother normally arrives at about 10:30 in the morning and then begins to drink dry sherry as if it's going out of fashion, which, sadly, it is. Sales are down, apparently, and now I fear unless they get someone like David Beckham or Ruthie Henschel to endorse it, I'm afraid it might disappear forever. My father comes too, of course, and usually brings with him a selection of bottled ales. Any other day of the year, if my father was carting booze around at that time in the morning, he'd get hell for it from my mother, but for some reason at Christmas, they're both blind to the madness. Recipe. Mulled wine. However, do not confuse my reticence with abstinence. I'm not totally impervious to festive cheer, and by midday I've almost certainly cracked on with a steaming jug of mulled wine. And what better than that distinctive aroma of cinnamon, orange and star anise filling your nostrils? Well, maybe hot fish and chips on a cold winter's day on the front in Wales next the sea. Also good for antiques, but apart from that, practically nothing. This recipe does require quite a few ingredients, but do not fret if you're lacking some. If you've 5 spice but no cloves, just chuck it in. Ditto ground ginger. Just please, 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 please don't use shop-bought mulling bags. Promise me. Thank you. For mulled wine, you will need red wine, bottle off. I prefer Spanish, but that's just me. Everyone does them nowadays, and it reports to be believed the Bulgarians are doing a very fine job. Cloves, 5 of. Star anise, 1 of. An orange, sliced. A cinnamon, in stick formation. Mixed spice, pinch of. Sugar to taste. Take a saucepan and pour the wine into it and then place it on the hob. Spike the slices of orange with your cloves and then add them with the cinnamon, star anise, mixed spice and sugar to the simmering mixture. Keep simmering and after, oh, I don't know, maybe 15 minutes, maybe more, certainly no less, you can serve. Some people also like to add some brandy, port or sloe gin. Obviously, it's up to you whether you do or not. A word of warning, though, do not mix your wines. Some people are inclined to add any old leftovers to the mulling pot, and you simply mustn't. Not unless you enjoy thumping headaches, i.e. you're the sort of person who's happy to listen to Radio 3 after about 10 o'clock in the evening, which maybe you are. Some people enjoy drinking soy milk out of preference. So really, anything's possible. It's not unheard of for the three of them, Anthony, my mother and my father, to be already talking far too loudly by the time we sit down for our starters at 2 p.m. We always start at 2 so that we can have eaten in comfortable time for the Queen's speech. Like attending midnight mass, listening to the Queen's speech is a tradition that I have always adhered to. I'm not normally a churchgoer, and nor do I normally hang off Her Majesty's every word, but traditions die awfully hard, it would seem, at this crazy and magical time of the year. I might say the same for charades, which we play after the Queen is over, and at which none of us is particularly accomplished. Last year I thought that my father had been gripped by sciatica as he flailed around trying to convey Silence of the Lambs to a terrified room, only to discover that he was merely trying to mime a sheep. Another tradition that should be mandatory, though, is, of course, sprouts. Certainly there are side effects to eating sprouts, but like A.C. Grayling's hair, this is simply something that we must all put up with. Such side effects are to be expected with all vegetables. The facts of the matter are that sprouts are magnificent, and without wishing to sound like that stool-sifting woman, it shouldn't be too much of an issue if you're already accustomed to eating vegetables in large quantities. And I am. Anthony less so, although I am slowly weaning him off white bread. Recipe. Brussels sprouts really do get an astonishingly bad press. And it's unfair, really. They seem to be associated only with Christmas and misery. And yet, they're actually in season pretty much from October all the way through until March. What's more, they can be a source of great joy and comfort, inspiration even, done well. They've suffered partly through a lack of imagination when it comes to cooking over the years. If the first time you were introduced to Brussels sprouts, they simply had a cross cut in their base and then been boiled in barely salted water for an hour and a half, then it's understandable that one might feel nauseous at the merest mention of them. But it never does to make your mind up about things simply on the basis of your first encounter. If it did, I would never have learned to love agers. The first time that I ever encountered an ager was during an oil shortage. The poor thing never got above room temperature, and all I could do as we stood around waiting the best part of an hour for a kettle to boil was despair slash marvel at the cream-coloured beast's enormity slash lack of efficiency. Had I walked away from the things there and then, I would have been in the wrong. I mean, I don't own one myself, but a number of friends who live in the country do, and I have been over the years the grateful recipient of some absolutely splendid roast potatoes. And what could be a nicer thing to dry your socks on after a decent yomp down some muddy country lanes than an arga? Let me answer that for you. Probably nothing, except perhaps possibly a cast-iron Victorian radiator. You know, the one sold in sections. Restored originals, not reproduction. I've got my eye on some for the study, actually. Not that I dry my walking socks in the study. Perhaps I would, though, if I got some restored section Victorian radiators. I've measured under the windows. I'd need 28 sections for the one on the left and 27 for the one on the right. Strange, really. To the naked eye, they look to be of identical width, but you get a tape measure out and, well, it's a very different story. As regards to sock drying, though, time will tell, I suppose. But, yes, first impressions. Not all they're cracked up to me. Much like silicon baking trays. Far too floppy. But sprouts. Sprouts, sprouts, sprouts. They're not at their best on their own. They're not at their best just boiled. Theirs is a texture best juxtaposed with something rather different, and that is why I often choose to go down the route of pairing them with pancetta. See what you make of these. Recipe. Brussels sprouts with pancetta. For this, you will need Brussels sprouts, about £3. I know it sounds a lot, but I just love the blooming things. Some pancetta, salt-cured, as you'd expect, and cubed. I buy the cured pork belly and then cube it myself, generously. You need about 3 ounces minimum, but don't be afraid to go for more. A half a dozen or so shallots, sliced as thinly as is humanly possible, about twice the thickness of a postage stamp if you've a decent set of knives. And I do've. Salt, both types. Table, for salt in the water. Sea, for seasoning. Malden, preferably, but then who's got the time to be choosy? Not I. Barely time to make my own phyllo pastry. I do, though. Barely time, I said. Not no time. Very different. Olive oil, extra virgin, lots of it. You're celebrating, remember? Some people include sun-dried tomatoes in this recipe. I don't. Makes it all too busy. And tomatoes just aren't Christmassy. They're summery, like polo shirts, genuine gelati, and basking on a blanket in one's own garden, slash a safe public park. Right then, take off some of the outer leaves of the sprouts if they really don't appeal, but otherwise throw the whole lot in a jolly big pan that's full of water that is already both salted and boiling, and also on the hob. So that's three things. Gosh, I don't know what the word is that does for three, what the word both does for two. Maybe it doesn't exist. It should do. It'd be jolly useful. Throth. Would that work? Troth. Someone should get on that anyway. And soon. Cook the sprouts for around 5 minutes until they're beginning to tender, but are also retaining a sensible degree of crispiness. Don't be afraid to use your teeth to find out if they're ready. Then drain them and let them dry further on a generous amount of kitchen paper, or an absorbent, i.e. much laundered, tea towel. Brand new ones, especially those from gift rather than cook shops, always seem to have some sort of sheen on them that renders them unfit for purpose. Then halve them, lengthways. Then take a large and heavy skillet, unridged, and heating some of the oil in it, add the shallots. Turn to a low temperature, stir continuously but gently, and allow the shallots to brown in their own time. Should be about 10 minutes, but don't become impatient now. They'll go brown when they want to. Once they're brown, remove them from the skillet and place them in an appropriate container slash vessel with an appropriate utensil. I'm thinking fish slice or last lick, something of that order at any rate, but ultimately, as with so much in life, the decision is yours. Then put more oil in the skillet, up the heat, and put the Brussels sprouts in, flat side, i.e. cut side, down. Then also add the pancetta. Now season and up the heat further. Keep stirring. Don't stop stirring. Stir until the sprouts are tender. Tender and brown. Then lower the heat, put the shallots back in the pan, and cook the whole lot, still stirring, for a handful of minutes. Season with yet more salt, place in your serving dish of choice, and expect serious praise and adoration from your nearest and dearest. It really does taste delicious. But then, I suppose anything does with the addition of olive oil and pancetta. Except porridge, oddly. But there we are. I suppose it's common sense. We actually leave it rather late in the day before unwrapping our gifts. Sometimes I think it's a shame to unwrap them at all. There's nothing in the world quite so wonderful, I often think, as a beautifully wrapped gift, done well. But I must say it has taken me an incredibly long time to persuade my nearest and dearest not to buy me cookery utensils and kitchen accoutrements as Christmas gifts. My kitchen is something that I am actually rather particular about and is, as such, one area of my life that I do like to be in complete control of. And here is the thing. I'm fairly confident that when it comes to kitchens, I already have absolutely everything that I need. And even when a new gizmo comes on the market and I deem the gizmo to be apt and necessary, they aren't always. Flavour shakers, anyone? Unbelievable. I will buy it for myself. I am a cookery writer. Things for the kitchen are what I need. They are the tools of my trade, an essential part of my armoury, and, I might add, tax-deductible. To buy such things as gifts for me is wholly unnecessary. I would personally not buy a cookery writer an item of cookware any more than I would buy a judge a Gavelin wig, or a Formula One driver a new set of mats for his footwell. I'm not sure the last of these is a totally successful comparison. I'm not, it may surprise you to hear, really a motorsports person, but I've popped it in there for spice. There are exemptions to this law, of course there are, and occasionally cookery writers I know well and I will exchange gifts of a culinary nature. We are only human, after all, and this is something done with a full understanding of each other's kitchens. Even then, it's not without risk. I once heard on the grapevine that Simon Hopkinson's Magimix blender had gone on the blink, and so had a replacement sent round in what I know to be his preferred colour as an advent treat. What I'd failed to gather, however, was that his machine was still under guarantee, and thus he'd already received a replacement gratis. Silly old me was left with a spare blender that I simply did not need, and was thus left searching for a home for it. I put the word out if anyone was in search of one, and I can happily tell you that it's now owned via a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend by the actor Neil Stuke, who apparently purees relentlessly. Another year, Matthew Ford and Faye Mashler both bought me identical granite pestle and mortar sets. This is not only unfortunate in terms of being a surfeit, but they also matched the colour of my own granite worktop too closely, and thus, whenever I'd put the thing down, I shan't tell you which I ended up using, I would have great difficulty finding the thing again. Giles Corran once sent me an egg slicer, but I assume that this was just a joke. I am more than capable of slicing my own eggs. It's just a question of having a sharp knife, soft hands, and a short grip. I'm fortunate enough to possess all three. Or should that be Throth? Or Troth? I really don't know. Anthony, you may be interested to know, bought me the complete Merchant Ivory box set. You'll think that I'm absolutely daft, but I've never actually managed to see Howard's End. I don't quite know how I've got by without it, but there we are. I'll be putting that right over the next couple of days. Keep having a very merry, sprout-filled Christmas. Bye-bye. At Home with Damien Trench was written and performed by Miles Jupp. The producer was Sir Michelle.